Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Today, we want to spend some time with Jeff Immelt. He was the 16-year CEO of the global giant GE. He took the reins of the storied American company on September 10th, 2001. And his tenure was, and this is his word, controversial. He led General Electric through the fallout from 9/11, the Enron collapse, the 2008 recession, and eventually moving the company's headquarters to Boston. In that time, he aimed to transform the 100-plus-year-old company to be more digital, more green, more nimble. But GE also struggled in that time, losing 30% of share value and some $150 billion in market capitalization. Immelt, who left GE in 2017, is out with a new book about his tenure in the corner office. It's called Hot Seat, What I Learned Leading a Great American Company. Jeff Immelt, welcome to WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So, you know, this question that I want to start with may seem really basic, but I'm interested in your answer, especially having read the book. What exactly is GE?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think GE is a 125-year-old basic American conglomerate. It's changed over time, as it should, as it needed to. And the GE that I kind of led for 16 years was really a high-tech infrastructure company that delivered solutions to customers around the world. But again, I think the fact that it's continued to adapt has also been part of the strategy. You know, Amazon 100 years from now is going to look different than Amazon looks today, as it should.
So you've been clear that with this book, you want to set the record straight on your tenure at this storied company. What was wrong with the narrative about GE in your 16 years as CEO? What did you want to set straight?
Yeah, look, I think I wanted to tell a more complete story. I think that truth equals facts plus context. I felt like the context had gone missing. The company wasn't perfect, but it did a lot more good things than bad. We generated $270 billion of earnings. We were number one in all the businesses we were in. We developed good leaders. We had a very strong reputation. At the same time, as you mentioned in your intro, the stock price didn't work. The succession didn't work as we wanted to. But I think the company was filled with a lot of good people that did their best. And I felt like their story, the work that they did, had really been distorted in the last 3 or 4 years.
You said the company's done more good than bad, and you've really leaned into both challenging and transparent conversations about the company with this book. I want to play with that more good than bad and talk a little bit about challenges of where it's been good then bad. And I'm thinking about places like a Pittsfield, Massachusetts, for example, where there was a long storied relationship between the company and the community. But after the company left, there's a long tail of pollution, for example, in the river there, cleanup that needs to be done. And that changes the sentiment and the relationship with the community when you're gone and there's a long tail of, for example, PCBs. So how do you think about when there's good, then bad? What is the relationship the company needs to have with communities?
Well, gosh, I think we've always tried to be a good citizen. As you've noticed, or as you noted in your intro, we're a company that's more than 125 years old. There are situations in communities where there needs to be continuous vigilance and cleanup. As it pertains to Pittsfield and in the Hudson River and things like that, I think the company always tried to be responsible and do our part, working with the EPA and state authorities. And I think we did that. You know, again, the people that worked in our environmental groups in Pittsfield and throughout the Hudson River, I think they should hold their head high because we were responsible and responsive to the state and federal authorities.
Jeff, I grew up in the Midwest where similar to the GE type of story, you know, there were, for example, lots of communities that were reliant on good middle class paying jobs from the auto industry that then left. And that has been, as GE, you know, to characterize it as a layperson would, moved out of manufacturing, also a piece of the picture, right? Communities that were built up across middle class, well paying jobs that then went away. And again, I'm struck in the book how you talk about shareholder value and understanding your relationship to those obligations. And I'm also struck by people, everyday people who might read the book and want to understand what that long-term responsibility and relationship is like for a company as big, as powerful, and with as much history as GE has had.
Well, gosh, I don't think you know me that well, but my father worked at GE for almost 40 years. So I grew up as one of those middle-class people. I always knew the value of a GE job. Nobody had to explain it to me. I always cherished that. I worked tirelessly to sell our products around the world because that's the only way you can ensure that these jobs will continue to be there and be competitive. In the last decade of my tenure, we moved appliances back to Louisville from Mexico. We invested billions of dollars in aviation technologies. We built wind turbines and life sciences products. And our net increase in manufacturing jobs over the last decade that I was CEO was quite substantial. So again, I actually appreciate your question, but I think to a certain extent, you're talking to the wrong guy in that context, because I kind of lived it my whole life. And I think if you read the book, yes, I talk about shareholder value, but I talk a lot more about employee connection, employee responsibility, and my focus on developing a generation of leaders who really understood where they fit in the world.
You know, you just said you think I'm talking to the wrong guy for that question, which made me think of the fact that there's another guy who figures into the book. We're not talking to him. You talk about him. He's now passed, which is the CEO and former Massachusetts native Jack Welch. I was really, honest to God, I couldn't decide how you wanted me to feel about Welch when the book was over. There were times when I thought you were praising him as a strong leader, and times when I thought you were saying you felt he had done a real disservice to the company in his focus on shows of growth. How should we think about Welch's legacy now?
I think you actually answered the question. I had a complicated relationship, I think, in the following way. Jack was an amazing CEO in the era that he served, and he did great things for the company, and really was a fantastic, high energy, high impact leader. But the world changed. The world changed dramatically after 9/11. It was more global. The digital age was very substantial. The whole notion of financial services changed slowly and then quickly. So the world and the company had to look very different. I think really what I hope readers see in the book is how much I learned from him, how much I respected him. But at the same time, following him was sometimes complicated. So I think the way you phrased the question was actually kind of appropriate, because he was amazing. He wasn't perfect, but I know for a fact he always did his best every day, as did I.
I know you've done a wide range of interviews already on this book. I've read some of them. We're Radio Boston, so Boston is in our hearts and in our focus. And obviously, GE came to Boston under your leadership. I was struck by the fact you talk about a lot of the big decisions you made as a leader in the book, everything from, you know, the GE Power deals to your desire to move green to turning GE into a digital company. I was struck by the fact that the desire to move to Boston isn't in the book. Did that not feel to you like a big leadership decision? I mean, it was big for Boston and for Massachusetts.
Yeah, no, fair question. You know, we wrote the book like a story, my co-writer and I, and it was very chronologically based. And to a certain extent, the decision to move to Boston, I was in on the early phases of it, but certainly didn't get it to see it to its conclusion. So I don't think there was any reason to slight it. It was just in the weight of the story, there were so many other things to talk about. But what I will say is, look, that's one that I always felt like was the right thing to do. I no longer live there, but I have great appreciation and respect for Boston. And I just think it's one of the world's great cities, and I'm happy that the company's headquartered there.
You said you didn't get to sort of see it through to its conclusion. We're still in that conclusion. You know, there were millions in tax incentives that were spent to lure GE here, a big headquarters planned in the seaport, talk of 800 jobs. You left. A little of that ended up happening, and I understand you were no longer CEO when many of those promises were broken or the incentives were clawed back, which also happened. But I do wonder, as a former CEO of GE, do you think the corporation owes anything to Boston and to Massachusetts that it hasn't done and needs to or should do?
Well, gosh, that's really an impossible question for me to answer, just because I'm just not current on all the things that are going on with GE. But I will say that companies, including the one that I worked at, do owe communities to be a good citizen, to be a responsible citizen, to live up to the things that you say you're going to do. Look, the only way you stay around for more than a century is because you have a good relationship, you know, what I would call a good win-win relationship with the towns you're in. And Boston, not just today, but over, you know, again, 100 years, has been a part of the GE history. And I think all CEOs, all business people need to respect that.
So you teach business school students now. I noticed that in the book, and you know, you're focused on lessons in this writing and sort of, you know, looking back on your leadership and getting the perspective on it that sometimes only leaving can change. We talked a little bit earlier in this discussion about shareholder value, which, you know, I don't think it's controversial to say can drive quarterly cycle management decisions. And yet you're talking about a more than 100-year-old company. How do you feel about the overwhelming push towards shareholder value and the fact that that can join sort of drive short-term decision making? And how are you teaching future leaders about those lessons?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the course I teach is really about transformational change, really in the digital arena. So that's been the essence of the course. But I do get a chance to, you know, converse with students about the things I've learned and things like that. And I guess the best thing I can offer is be transparent. Know the businesses that you're in and be true to the businesses that you're in. In our case, the aviation business, which is, you know, still got a factory in Lynn, Massachusetts, it takes decades of investment, tremendous quality control, tremendous science, great workforce. You have to have all those things to be successful in that business. It takes, you know, when you invest in a new engine, it's $1 billion plus. It doesn't pay off for 10 or 20 years. And so I think the important thing is just to be transparent about the business you're in. Investors who are looking for that to be different or for looking for an aircraft engine to pay back in 6 months, they shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't own the stock of the company. So I think it's all about being true to the businesses you're in and being transparent about what the strategies are. And those are things we always try to do.
One investment you wish you'd made that you didn't?
Oh gosh, I can go back in time and say after 9/11, it was a little bit like COVID in that the commercial aviation business was really in completely in a bad cycle. And I wish I had acquired as much of our supply chain as I could have, because over the next 20 years, it would have just been a great investment. And then I just think the company never became as digital as I wanted it to be or as it should be. And I wish we had done more things there as well.
Why was it important for the company to be more digital than it became.
Again, I just think the transformation around how products are used by airlines and hospitals and utilities and wind turbines, it's more about information today than it is about physics of the product, and our ability to be a better partner with our customers is really going to be about new technologies like artificial intelligence and machine learning. And I just think that's you just have to lean in to those technologies. You know, I sit today in California, and the amount of innovation that's going taking place today is just unparalleled. And you know, going back to the aviation example, you could wake up tomorrow and see Elon Musk announce an all-electric aircraft with $10 or $15 billion of funding, and the whole industry would change, and things like that will happen.
We're going to have to end it there. That's Jeff Immelt, former chairman of GE. His new book is Hot Seat: What I Learned Leading a Great American Company. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you.